Hi, I'm Chris Irwin. Welcome to The Come Up, a podcast that interviews entrepreneurs and leaders.
Very early on in House of Highlights lifespan, I became a really big fan of the account. I think we've had about 500,000 followers. At this point, we would have these quarterly board meetings, and I ran through this deck which outlined our pivot to social. And on the last slide, I had something that I really did not want to be a throwaway, but I kind of was like, there's a good chance this is going to be a throwaway, was this pitch to acquire House of Highlights. Luckily enough, the people in that room, again, didn't dismiss it. They were like, okay, make it happen.
This week's episode features Doug Bernstein, the GM of House of Highlights, which is part of Bleacher Report. Doug grew up in Long Island and actually predicted his sports media career in third grade. In just middle school, he was making his own football cards, and while in college, accidentally ended up running the school paper and public access TV channel, where he cut his teeth learning how to sell ads, be on camera, and inspire a team. Then Doug got his real digital education when he went to AOL to run sports and news blogs. There, he realized that the next fandoms would be powered by user-generated content and social media. So he made the jump to Bleacher Report. At Bleacher, he ended up leading the acquisition of House of Highlights and now runs one of today's most exciting sports media brands. Some highlights of our chat include what he learned from responding to 400 blogger emails per day, how he convinced Turner to double down on digital, why he's inspired by FaZe Clan and 100 Thieves, and fulfilling his destiny as a sports media savant. All right, let's get into it. Doug, thanks for being on the Come Up podcast.
My pleasure. Very excited to be here.
Let's zoom back a bit and let's talk about where you grew up and what your household and your parents were like. So I think you mentioned you grew up in Long Island. Is that right?
That is correct. So I grew up in a town called Garden City, which is a suburb of New York City. It was me, my brother, who's 3-4 years younger than myself, and my mom and dad. And we just grew up in a really, really big sports household. You know, a lot of my earliest memories are in and around sports. My dad loves to tell a funny story. Like, you know, when I was one, he was supposed to watch me and he got stuck, you know, on the WFAN call radio. My mom came home. I had like a wet diaper, crying, screaming, and he was still online to talk about the Yankees. So, you know, I grew up playing a lot of soccer, watching a lot of basketball, playing soccer, basketball, and lacrosse. And then really just became infatuated with the Giants, like the New York Giants, at a very, very young age. So
yeah, I was actually going to ask, like, what were the teams of your household? Who did you guys root for?
I am a very big and loyal diehard New York Giants fan. My brother has been more Jets, but also somewhat of a colors guy. Like if they had good colors, he'd kind of go in that direction. And my dad has always, like, he's never had like a set team. But, you know, I've always been a really, really big Giants fan. To the point that I think it like scared my parents when I was younger. I remember when I was in like the third grade, the Giants had a loss. And I like put a note under my door. I went upstairs, put a note under my door. I was like, I'm not coming out until the start of next season. Knock on my door, put Rice Krispie cereal at the door. I'll eat it, but I'm going to stay in my room until the start of next season.
How long did that last for?
I think it lasted until the next morning. I think my parents gave me a full like, you know, Sunday, we're not going to bother him. And then Monday, you got to go to school. And then, you know, like we went to a lot of St. John's basketball games growing up. And that was a really formative experience. I loved going to like those games with my dad and with my brothers and being part of that atmosphere.
What did you like about the live experience?
It was just everything. You know, it was, you know, so cool to be able to watch the games. But also, I think what I like really gravitated towards was the people and the connections that were being made. So like every year, there'd always be like, you know, the same older couple that would sit right in front of us, you know, the same people that would sit behind us and next to us, and kind of those like those friendships and that camaraderie. Like I even remember, like, you know, like when you're in kindergarten, first grade, like these people, then you see them and then you see them again all the way through middle school. It's a really, you know, unique experience to kind of have that. I grew up in a very non-religious household. So, you know, we rarely went to church. We rarely went to temple.
The sports arena was your temple.
Exactly. So like sports was that place where you kind of like congregated. I always remember when I would go to church, there'd be that like that moment where you shake people's hands and say, peace be with you. And I was like, always felt like when I was at a game, it was like the heightened version of that where you're like, clapping people going crazy and, you know, kind of having that feeling. So I love being able to go to games. I think that was like really, really formative for myself.
You're going to games with your family, like imagine through like your early years and in middle school. Was there a feeling like, I'm probably going to end up, you know, in sports in my career in some way? When was that early glimpse?
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember in second grade, I would have to write journal entries and I would write these like 5-page journal entries every Monday about like the Giants recap. And then like every Wednesday would be like, you know, this three-page recap on the St. John's game. And the teacher was like, why are you writing such long things about like these sports? Like you're supposed to write about like, you know, what you ate for breakfast and, you know, what you did with your friends. So I remember that like very distinctly, like standing out. I remember very distinctly in third grade and my mom saved it. We were supposed to write about what it was we wanted to do when we were older, when we had a real career. And I wrote, be a professional soccer player or work for ESPN. So clearly it was not good enough to be a professional soccer player, but did end up working for ESPN. And, you know, I was really lucky that I had parents that kind of fostered it, where we went to Bristol when I was in like fourth grade and visited the ESPN campus. You know, all of our vacations, like we went to watch Duke in North Carolina. Like, I don't know how my mom tolerated all this. We went to watch like US soccer in San Diego. Like a lot of our vacations as a kid were geared towards like going to these sporting events.
Oh, wow.
It was really fun. I didn't really have like a great context for work because my grandfather had started a company. My dad worked for that company. My uncles had worked for it. So there was always this kind of like, oh, like that's the path is you work for this family business.
Was it sports related at all? Or
No. I like to say they make like widgets. So they may start off making fuses for TV. They make computer components, just like a little electrical equipment type stuff. So it was like the furthest thing from my interest area. But, you know, as I got older, was lucky enough to kind of break into sports and not have to pursue that.
I think you had also mentioned too, did you at an early age have to create your own basketball cards and fantasy football mags? So you had some like sports entrepreneurship in you at an early age too.
So I'm definitely putting my sports nerd hat very heavily right now. So I was going through all our old boxes of cards when cards was having that big resurgence of late. And I stumbled across, you know, a Kobe that should have been worth $40,000, but the edges were dented. That was heartbreaking. But I also stumbled across all these cards that I would make, you know, Tim Duncan, Randolph Childress, you know, like Smocky Walker, like all these guys, Vince Carter, Antoine Jameson, I would make, they didn't make college basketball cards. So I would make their card. I'd have an index. I get the magazine. I print up a little, like cut out the picture, find all their stats, write the stats in the back, give them a little bio. And it's when I didn't have the pictures I would draw, because I liked to do a lot of art as a kid. So I would do that. I'd, you know, make little fantasy magazines and things of that nature, which are always really fun.
Were these just for you or were you selling these to your friends?
Yeah, I'd sell them to my brother, basically.
Keep it in the family.
Right. It would be me and my brother would constantly be like collecting basketball cards, trading them. And then we would build little teams that my dad or, you know, my dad's friends would then judge. So we did a lot of that. We played like backyard basketball. And my mind went on me to like, okay, we're playing backyard basketball, but we need to make a league out of this. So like, I was like making jerseys like in like the fifth grade for like all my buddies to play in this like non-official backyard basketball league. So I've kind of always had that in me.
I didn't realize you had such a creative bent to you as well. Very interesting to hear this. Like, because I look at you as like the data analytics and strategy mind behind House of Highlights and a lot of the work that Bleacher Report is doing. But hearing you that you're like making jerseys and making sports cards and like drawing characters and all that. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's funny. Like if you were to talk to like any of my high school teachers or my wife, I think they would think it's comical that like I started in the data and analytics side because I think I got like a 2 on AP stats and got like a 5 or 4 on AP art. So I think they were like very like, wait, what? You know, like that doesn't really jive. But yeah, you know, I think what has helped me a little bit with the data and analytics side is being able to like interpret it more creatively and be able to kind of have, I always wanted to be, you know, kind of more on the editorial side, whether that's like a writer or a talent, but you know, I couldn't write that well. And wasn't that great of a talent. Like was a terrible talent. And then, you know, what I always have, I always had ideas. So I figured, hey, if I can't do that, let me at least come with ideas. And then nobody wanted to listen to me. So I was like, all right, well, I've got to have it rooted in something. That's kind of how the numbers came about.
Got it. Well, look, I think you got to test some of your editorial and talent muscles when you were in Pomona for college. So I think you made a decision that you wanted to pursue this sports media career. So you went and did media studies at Pomona, and you went from the East Coast to the West Coast to do that. Tell me about when you were like at undergrad, what type of work were you doing? What type of work were you doing outside the classroom? And how is that inspiring your future sports career?
Yeah, I mean, I was a media studies major at a small liberal arts school in California, which is really, really fun and enjoyable, but it's not giving you the most preparation for a postgraduate life, right? Like if you want to, you know, dissect like 1970s cinema, like you're in great shape, but there's only so many jobs where you're going to be able to do that after college. So, yeah. You know, for me, I enjoyed school. I think Pomona was a great college to be able to study media, play some sports. But I think I really found, you know, what it was that I love once I was able to start doing things outside of the classroom. And, you know, my first experience with that was I was on the soccer team. You know, a teammate came up to me after practice one day and said, "Hey, do you want to work for the school paper?" I said, "Oh man, I'd absolutely love that. I've been thinking about, you know, sports writing or stuff like that for a while. That'd be great." So he's like, "Okay, meet me under the campus bookstore. We'll get going." And I meet him under the campus bookstore. I'm all, you know, ready to meet the team or whatever, meet my editor. And he's like, "Hey, here are the keys. This is the office. The whole staff quit. This thing's yours." So that was a real baptism by fire, you know, like inheriting a college newspaper. You know, I think it was like $5,000 in debt, which at that time, $5,000 in debt felt like, you know, $500,000. And then, yeah, you know, kind of being able to lay out a vision for what I wanted the paper to be, build a staff, execute against it, do some sports writing. Like,
I have to ask, in that moment, did you get more excited where like, okay, there's a little bit of shock value here. I'm going to have to like build this from scratch, but I'm going to make it in my own vision. And I know what that looks like. And I'm going to recruit people that are excited by this and all the above? Or was it like, I'm not sure if I actually want to like, you know, take this on?
No, I was like way more excited. I was like, this is way okay. better. You know, like, I think yeah. I didn't really like, wasn't very enamored with the traditional school papers, you know, like a lot of the stuff that they were covering. So, you know, we ended up kind of pivoting and doing a lot more music and movie reviews, a lot more like things outside of the school.
It's like Bill Simmons in The Ringer, you know, it's like integrating like sports and pop culture.
Exactly. I think just like I was in school in 03, 04 when I started doing this. I think our first cover was The Ultimate Movie Badass. It was like a 64 bracket Ultimate Movie Badass thing. So that was, you know, that was really, really fun. And that was it. Yeah, that was it exactly. It was like, man, I get to see out the vision or the creative that I would like for this to be. And that was really, really exciting. And, you know, the ability to not just do the creative side, but also it was really, really beneficial because I also had to do the business side. So I had to sell ads, you know, go to like the local pizza store, go to like the local laundromat.
Oh, so you were like door knocking, like you had to drive revenue for the business as well and help pay off the debts.
Yeah, we had to like make phone calls. We had to, you know, get ad sales, had to like pick up checks and like get a chicken parm at the same time. So yeah, definitely had to do like all of that. And it was fun because it was an independent college paper. It wasn't like supported by the school itself. So it was like, you really had like a P&L that you had to drive towards. And it was a great experience for a 20-year-old to be able to do that.
Did you get college credit? That sounds like the best way to learn how to build like a sports media organization.
I think I ended up getting school credit. So I think, you know, the second half of my junior and senior year, a lot of my credits were coming from like independent work. So I think I got credit from doing the school paper. I believe we had a public access college television channel that had long been dormant. So I started to be like, oh man, what's this? This looks pretty fun. I befriended the faculty advisor. It's like the world's nicest man. He was 80 something years old. He worked at the theology school adjacent to where we were. And so I was like, oh, is there anything I could do for the school television channel? He's like, yeah, just run tapes back and forth, upload like a thumb drive and, you know, make a PowerPoint of like what's happening this week, what like who's speaking. I was like, oh, that's great. And then when I went to meet him one time, they had an abandoned TV studio. And I was like, wait, you have a TV studio here? And he's like, yeah. I was like, and nobody uses it? And he was like, no, nobody's used it in years. And I was like, if me and my buddies come and clean it out, can we use it? And he was like, go for it. So me and my buddies spent, you know, a Saturday and Sunday cleaning the whole thing out. It was like a 3-camera studio, had like a switcher in the other room. And we cleaned the whole thing out. And, you know, every Sunday for the remainder of the year, we filmed two of my buddies did a politics show, and then me and one other buddy did a sports talk show.
Wait, how did you learn how to use the studio of like using the switcher and like the multicam operation? Who taught you that?
This guy, the guy who had been like, you know, this really, really kind man, took a lot of like empathy on us and would come like Sundays after church and like would help us learn how to film and learn how to do the switchers. And then I would go home and I put it in, you know, whatever Mac editing software I had at the time and, you know, edit together pretty crudely, but it was, you know, it was decent enough. Again, it was just a really, really fun learning experience to be able to have done that. And then, you know, was able to do that and then get credit for internships that I was able to do during school as well.
I also have to ask, I think you had previously mentioned that you had some, I think, leadership pillars or philosophies that you had printed in the office at the school paper. And I think you still have a copy of this or you still use these pillars today. What is that?
It's like actually like, I mean, I don't need to take time to get it, but it's like 10 feet from me. I do have the like, the little like 5-page write-up of like the guiding principles for that school paper that are very applicable 15 years later to overseeing House of Highlights. And I think, you know, as part of those leadership principles, a lot was about like laying out a very clear and concise vision, allowing everybody to really understand their roles, but also kind of this like this mantra that I've had and that I've kind of liked a lot was you don't have to like each other, but you always got to root for each other. And when you think about that, right, like it's with any team or any organization, you know, sometimes there's an expectation that, oh, we all have to be friends. We all have to love each other. Yeah. And it's like, that's not really the case. You know, I think the best case scenario is that you're all swimming in the same direction. Somebody's failure is your failure. Somebody's success is your success. I'm a big believer that like negativity is contagious and positivity is contagious. And when you set the framework that what you have to do at the core is root for each other. So when we're like, any person that we interview with, the last thing I tell them is like, this is our guiding principle for when you join our team is like, you're not going to like everybody, right? We don't always get along with our coworkers, but you really, really genuinely do have to be rooting and pulling for them. And that's been something that I think's worked pretty well for us and myself to date, I think.
Doug, you're so speaking my leadership language. I use the word positivity often. And I agree. And, you know, a similar value for us is that we have, you know, like always strive for excellence.
Right.
And that might require having difficult conversations with clients or with team members. I've learned as a leader that if you always introduce a shared objective, which is like, look, we're working to do excellent work or to create something amazing. So I'm going to give you some candid feedback for how you can be better, for how we can be better. Then it always lands differently. So I really like how you think about it. And I also like whenever you're recruiting someone to your team, that you're making that expectation very clear up front. And it also kind of, it has like a good sports vibe to it as well.
Right, exactly.
So let's talk about all this incredible college experience and then your early career starts. And I think the first job you land at, if I'm right, is at the NFL in around 2007.
That's correct. So yeah, I had done an internship at the Tennis Channel in Santa Monica, which was really a great introductory experience. Just, you know, all the internship stuff, logging tapes, doing research, learning to use Excel spreadsheets, all that stuff. Did another internship at NFL Films, which again was a little bit more of the same. Again, a little bit more baptism by fire. I remember one of my first shoot, I didn't know if I wanted to be in programming or production. I went on a production shoot. They said, we have a shitty job for you. I said, like, all right, I'm down. Let's do it. You know, first big internship opportunity. They said, there's dog shit in the backyard. Can you go pick it up? And I was like, oh, okay. Maybe being a PA is not for me. And then I did an internship the second semester at ESPN Classic Now. So I felt really prepared for coming out of school. And then like most graduates, it's harder to get a job than you would expect. I think it took me about 4 to 6 months to finally land something. And that was after school. So, you know, spent a lot of time over that final senior year trying to get a job. And getting a break into sports is a really, really tough industry. And I remember there, I met with a friend's father who was like, I told him I wanted to work in sports and he legitimately like laughed at my face. He's like, okay, good luck, have fun. Talk to me when that doesn't pan out. So I was like, oh no, is that true? But was fortunate enough to kind of land at the NFL. And it was just a great way to get like my foot in the door. Basically, players get a percent bonus based on the number of plays they're in. So I was responsible for the monotonous job of keying in, looking at a picture, and keying in who was in that play, looking at their number, 89, 78. and then just doing that for every play of an NFL game.
Players get a bonus for the more amount of plays that they're in. Are you talking from like a media coverage point of view or just from like, no, like playing on the team point of view?
Like a tight end, right? If you're in a certain percentage of snaps, you'll receive a bonus, like a performance bonus. So the team can't do it, and then their representative can't do it. So they have the league as a neutral agent do this. So I think it's a little known thing, but I don't know if it still exists, but at the time, for every NFL game, this is a great job. There's somebody that just goes behind each field goal and takes a picture of the left side of the field, the center, and the right side, zooms out, takes one more. And then there are people that just key in those players. So think about sports is there's always these little jobs, you know, that people aren't aware of, and that it is just taking whatever chance you can get that helps propel you to that next step. Because, you know, you are in the NFL office, you do see the commissioner, you do get to send emails and experience things. So it was fun. I was there for a couple of months before bouncing over to ESPN.
At these low-level jobs, were you getting more excited about entering into sports media? Were you getting a little disenchanted a bit? Or was it, no, it's like, hey, I like this, but I just need to find my path, and the role that I'm in is like not it, but I'm going to get there. What were you feeling in that moment?
One, excited to have a job, right? Like you're just like very appreciative and grateful for the job. It was, I think, a 6-month role. So I was like, man, I really got to find something full time. So it was like that, like appreciation, but also combined with angst of being able to find that full time role and trying to land at a spot that felt like more, it was like growing your career, which is kind of what that position at ESPN ended up being.
You know, I think you end up at Versus for a little bit, but then you end up at AOL as a product manager at Flea Flicker, right? So what was that role as a product manager? Because that seems like an evolution of what you had been doing.
Honestly, as a customer service rep, a product manager sounds way better, but the way I backed into it is kind of funny. You know, I worked at ESPN for a year and basically was cutting games down for replays. You know, if you're ever up at 2 a.m. watching a college football game, I'd watch it live and then cut it down, or I'd, you know, re-air sports centers, screen sports centers for re-airs, like Brazilian and all these other languages. It's really fun. It was like 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. And I had always had this window where I would get ratings numbers. So I started to like really dive into the analytics of the ratings and was like very, very curious about it. You know, just how my brain works is like, if there's a star in the game, how does that perform? If it's 2 top 10 teams, how does that perform? If it's close, how does that do? If it's a blowout, how does that do? And I started just doing this research late at night by myself just to kill time. I was like, you know, I might as well do something with it. So I forwarded on to some people within ESPN, like, oh, wow, this is actually pretty interesting. And they started to like share it and started to, you know, have interview opportunities within ESPN that were kind of in ratings or research. But, you know, I was a very ambitious 22-year-old kid. My wife came up to Bristol in Connecticut, which isn't the world's most exciting place. It wasn't for her. So that's why I bounced over to Versus, where I was able to kind of do the ratings and the analytics side, kind of going to TV programming, which is where I wanted to land. And as I was doing the TV programming, I ran into a couple of challenges. You know, one, Versus, which is now NBC Sports, Hunting and Fishing Network. I'm a Jew that's never hunted or fished. So that wasn't the world's best fit. And also just, I struggled in the role. Like it was a role that required a lot of attention to detail, like the minutia. And that was something that like I wasn't like the best at, wasn't given like that much autonomy, which is probably right for, you know, a very, very junior level role, and kind of struggled. And as I was doing that, I was having a hard time. You know, they were looking to move to Philadelphia. I'm a New York sports fan. There's no way I'm moving to Philly. So I had like kind of this like, you know, couple of months where they were just kind of unwinding things at that office. And you know, wanted to kind of keep my brain really engaged. So I created like the world's worst fantasy website is how I describe it. It had a good name. It was called Keyboard GM. And I aggregated fantasy football rankings from like different websites. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like maybe I could do something in digital. I love digital because as I was doing that fantasy football stuff and kind of learning to code a little bit and build like a really janky website, I also was doing a sports blog with a couple of buddies from ESPN. And this was early, mid-aughts sports blogging. And really, one of the challenges on the TV side was if you had an idea, it'd be like 3 months to get in front of the right person, 3 months of like sounding it out. Best case scenario, it gets approved. It's like a 6 months of production. And then it's on the air and it's like the difference between a 0.1 or a 0.12. I was like, man, that's a tough process. And then when I was doing the digital stuff with my buddies, we would just create articles that we wanted to read every day. And if they resonated, we'd be like, oh, that's awesome. Let's do more of that. If they didn't, we'd scale all that. We'd be like, okay, let's not do that again.
This is all on Keyboard GM.
So there was Keyboard GM, which was the fantasy football website. And I had, I think it was called like sportsblog.net. Go way back for you. PSD, sportsblog.net. And then that was where we just kind of blogged. So there was two separate things that I was doing in the digital space. You know, I was in this period where I was just trying to find something to continue to working in sports. Ideally wanted to get into digital. My mom sent me this job as like a product manager at a fantasy football website. And I was like, all right, let's go. It'll be great.
She sent you a newspaper clipping with like a red circle around it?
Yeah, pretty much. It really was a customer service rep job at first. And, you know, people I like to say they started in like the mailroom. You hear like that a lot, right? I was like to say I started in the digital mailroom because this is like a classic AOL thing where they bought a fantasy football website. They didn't tell any of their existing users. They just transferred them over to this new website. So I was answering like 400 to 500 emails a day from customers about, hey, what, why are you transferring? Where's my lineup? Where's my all this? But it was a really, you know, kind of rewarding experience. I learned a lot about how to interact with your audience, your customer, your consumer. When you're playing in, you know, the world's most detailed fantasy football league where it's like 32 team keeper league with full IDPs, like you really have a level of understanding for your users that, you know, kind of is not surface level. Like you get to know users on a one-on-one basis. You get to know who your fans are, how to cater to your super fans, how to, you know, understand what really is an issue and what really isn't an issue and work side by side. You know, there was a programmer that founded it, a guy named Ori Schwartz, who was, you know, really beneficial in that he talked to me about what a roadmap is, which is something that like I had no idea before, right? You know, and really coached me up on the way of the digital world and a product and how to think not just of this week or next week, but 3, 6 months, a year out. And it also taught me a lot, which, you know, become somewhat thematic over the course of my career, is about being a startup within a bigger organization. So Flea Flicker was, you know, kind of this very small startup within AOL Sports and within this massive AOL Time Warner ecosystem. And then that, you know, has played out really similar when it was like Bleacher Report got acquired. I was like, okay, a lot there. And then when we acquired House of Highlights, I had the same thought. Like I hearkened back to it and was like, oh wait, what worked for Ori, this one guy, was like just a lot of autonomy and freedom and not trying to be micromanaged. And when we, you know, acquired Omar and House of Highlights, it was that same mindset. So, you know, I was able to do that fantasy football side of things for about a year or two. And then what happened was because I had the analytics and the ratings research background, they said, hey, could you start pulling numbers for, you know, Flea Flicker, the fantasy football website? I said, sure, would love to. And then because nobody else was doing that and digital analytics didn't exist at the time, they said, hey, can you start doing it for sports? And I was like, absolutely, would love that. And then, you know, before you
I just love how you're so, like, you're so positive and excited about trying new things. Hey, listeners, this is Chris Irwin, your host of The Come Up. I have a quick ask for you. If you dig what we're putting down, if you like the show, if you like our guests, it would really mean a lot if you can give us a rating wherever you listen to our show. It helps other people discover our work, and it also really supports what we do here. All right, that's it, everybody. Let's get back to the interview. How, like, did you create a culture and a mindset where, like, today at House of Highlights, like, you trial so many different revenue streams and products for fans, right? Sports creator competitions, like, talent and streetwear collaborations to create new, like, new merch designs for different leagues and teams. And I'm like, where do these ideas come from? And how'd you get there? And I'm hearing you talk about your entire history and career. You're like, oh yeah, I'm going to learn how to like run a school newspaper, learn to be a writer. I'm going to learn how to run like a TV studio and like be on camera. I'm going to learn analytics. I'm going to start my own digital blog and fantasy blog. Like, so now I get it. And so again, you just jump into this new opportunity in data analytics with a very open and ambitious kind of point of view. So, okay. I just wanted to note that for the listener. So now what happens?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wanted to learn, right? And my mom was bugging me about going back to like business school or grad school or whatever it might be. I just love digital media. Like just my own internal self was like, why does this happen? Why does this happen? Like, what if you did this? Like, they say, how do you grow a sports website was of immense interest to me. So at the time we were living in the city, my office was about 5 blocks from where I lived, but my wife reverse commuted into Queens. So she would have to leave for work at about 6 o'clock. So I would go with her every morning and then I'd be in the office by 6 o'clock. And this is, you know, AOL, people aren't scrolling into like 9:30, 10. So for 3.5, 4 hours, you know, I had the office to myself basically. And I was responsible for creating a daily report that looked at 40 different properties, whether it was like AOL, cut it up every way, like puppies, kittens, kids, dog, like you name it, like they had it, and really was able to understand, like that was my grasp of, essentially. It was like come in every day and I'd study the metrics for homepage traffic, from search traffic, from engagement, what articles did well, what articles didn't do well, what writers did well. And just every single day, you know, or 5 days a week was responsible for like not just churning out this report, but also really starting to like internalize what correlated to the numbers. And, you know, I spent a lot of time sitting with the editorial team, and there was, you know, a really incredible editorial team that I had all the time, a guy named Randy Kim. And I just had too many ideas I knew what to do with. And I needed to check myself and learn like, okay, well, this is what the writer's thinking about. This is what the editor's thinking about. This is what the editor-in-chief is thinking about. These are all the things that we've done in the past and why your idea doesn't work. You know, this is what the designer thinks about. And I think really learning before doing helped me a lot in that role. That was a big thing. Was there were people that would come in straight out of grad school that were, I'm sure, way smarter than me and way better with numbers. But I think one of the things that worked to my benefit was that I had spent an inordinate amount of time listening and learning and gaining the trust of the people that I was going to be working with. So when I gave a recommendation based on numbers, it wasn't just like, oh, here's the numbers, right? Like, it was like, or here's a number guy. Like, you know, again, this is like Moneyball days where like, get the number guy out of here. It was like, you know, really trying to be deferential, especially at first. And I put a big focus on, like, I would say, like, not trying to be a weatherman when it came to the numbers, but trying to be a doctor, not just saying like, hey, the temperature was this, it's going to be hotter or colder, like up or down, but really trying to be prescriptive in terms of saying like, okay, this is the problem, this is what's going on, and these are potential solutions for how you can solve it.
I think a theme of your career is making sports more engaging and relatable for younger audiences. So I think like, as you start to look at some of the analytics from these 40 different AOL properties, what were like a couple revelations that you were getting, call it in like, either like the mid-aughts or in around 2008 to 2011, that maybe you were seeing that others weren't, that your leadership was like, whoa, Doug, like you really get this in a unique way. What was that?
So a lot initially was focused on search. And I think a lot of it was, you know, had traditional, you know, newspaper people that thought of things a certain way. So you write one story on one topic at a particular time. And, you know, what we were starting to see, you know, especially on that search perspective was, the interest wasn't just when the editorial staff dictated it, right? So if we did a mock draft, an NFL mock draft, mid-season, like historically you only did mock drafts like the week before the draft. Like it was like sacrilegious to be able to do a mock draft like any more than like a week or two out. But when I was like, hey, if we could do a mock draft at the midpoint of the current season, I think it would do really well. Or at like the end of the college football season, we would see that do really, really well. And I was like, oh, wow, like there's a level of interest and engagement here that's not being met yet. People were interested in it. They were searching for it, but there was nothing there for them. So that was a big one. And then the other big one was just like, if a news story broke, for a while I worked really closely with the AOL news team. So like if a tornado happened, right, or anything that is newsy, politics, or whatever, traditionally they would just write the one AP style recap. And what we started to do was say like, okay, well, let's not just write the recap. Let's write like five. And now these are so commonplace that like, it seems silly, but at the time, nobody's really doing this. The 5 things you need to know on this topic, breaking down, like, who is this person that, you know, was at the center of this, you know, not just having one story of recapping a news event, but having like a template of 10 to 20 different stories that depending on like, is this a tier 1 event or a tier 3, you'd be like, okay, we need 5 stories on it And these are the five potential stories that you could do.
It's like early inspiration for BuzzFeed, you know, starting, you're like one of the first listicles.
Right. It was. It was like at the time, like BuzzFeed was struggling with SEO. And I remember thinking, it was like, man, it's not that hard. Like they were doing a lot better than a lot of other stuff. But yeah, like at that time, like I think, you know, some of the stuff that AOL was doing and Bleacher Report and Huffington Post was like very early days, like digital media optimization, SEO optimization.
Got it. You just brought up Bleacher Report. And I think that that's a great segue, actually, into your transition to the company, which I think happened in 2011. So tell me, like, what caused the move? What was the impetus? And then what was your first role there?
Yeah, so the impetus was twofold. So partially was based on my current situation. So I was at AOL, and they had shuttered AOL Sports Fan House, which was the kind of their internal AOL Sports brand. And I was working on everything but sports, doing analytics, and that just didn't sit quite well. I was constantly reverting back to thinking about what can I be doing in sports. And then on the flip side was over the final couple of months that AOL Sports Fan House was around, I was responsible for looking at our Comscore reports. And I would see in Comscore, you know, our competitors and who was doing what. You know, every month I would see Bleacher Report coming up, and I would see next month them coming up. And, you know, I was like, oh, this is really interesting. One of my friends from college went to school with a couple of their founders, so I was familiar with it. And I had worked with the guy at AOL Sports who ended up going over there as an editorial lead. He said, hey, we're in the market for somebody to do analytics, and I think you would be an interesting person for it. Would you be open to it? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. This feels perfect.
So you jump over to Bleacher, and I bet you're thinking you're really into sports and digital. It's an early stage company because I think Bleacher was started around 2005, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, probably like, yeah, around there, five, six, seven.
Got it.
Like, you know, when it was actually like official is probably to be debated, but somewhere around there for sure.
And so there's probably like in your mind, like the ability for you to shape the company as well, right? To get in early.
I was employee number 40, which at the time I didn't really contextualize, but now being a little bit older, it's really special to be in on a company at that level. To me, it felt really well established. But again, having a little bit more perspective on it now, I can see how nascent it really was. I remember when I would tell people I work for Bleacher Report early on, I don't think anybody knew what I was talking about. So that was really great. And I was doing the analytics at AOL and had some ability to kind of be a part of decision making. But really, it was still from like an arm's length, and I think they were being very kind to me. But then when I went to Bleacher Report, I was kind of shocked, to be honest, that, like, you know, it was the exact opposite, where it was very analytics driven, very much about optimization, very much about giving the fan what they wanted, in particular, the younger fan. So Dave Finocchio, who founded it, was one of the founders of Bleacher Report and has been, you know, just an incredibly brilliant guy that's been really, really instrumental to my career. And Rory Brown, who was my first boss at Bleacher Report, who have also remained really close. And again, another brilliant guy. They both, you know, were really critical in establishing a culture that was very much about, let's try things, let's look at numbers, and let's try to have fun, I guess, in the process. And it was just the perfect fit for somebody like myself that had all of these ideas of what I wanted to have covered in sports. And those were shared by Rory, Dave, and Bleacher Report as a whole. And then be able to go off and kind of execute that and grow it and build it and keep growing it and keep building and like fail, you know, a ton was super, super exciting. It was just like an incredibly exciting time to be at Bleacher Report, you know, as it was growing from, I think when I got there, I want to say like sub 10 million uniques to, I think, you know, we reached a point where it's like 40 million uniques. And I think when we got there, it's like 8 million search visits a month to a point where it had 60 million. And to be a part of that growth was really incredible.
And so for our listeners, what was Bleacher Report when you started?
Yeah, so when I started up Bleacher Report, it was just a sports website with about 100% user-generated content. You know, those were the initial iterations. I think, you know, pretty quickly on into me coming aboard, we started to have a little bit of an internal team where it wasn't all user-generated. There were people that we staffed to write certain stories. We began to build out a newsletter product, which then ultimately became an app. But, you know, when I think I started, it was just strictly a website that was largely driven by user articles. And that was it. That was the main crux of it.
Fast forward to today, And Bleacher Report is a multi-platform media brand that's acquiring live rights and has acquired sub-brands like House of Highlights, and there's probably other things, and you're doing creator competitions and so much more. We'll get to that story. But okay, about a year in though, you were then acquired by Turner, which is kind of like you leaving the Turnership and then kind of like going back through this. When that was announced, were you part of those deal talks at all? Or did you just found out? What did you feel? Were you excited or you're like kind of confused about why is this happening?
I don't remember if I think I was more excited than not. I think I remember that. It is funny because I was like at AOL Time Warner and then I left and then immediately got put like back on AOL Time Warner. I think I've been in like four iterations of Time Warner. So I think I was, you know, mostly excited, a little bit of trepidation because, you know, when you join a bigger media company, you don't know exactly how that's going to unfold, how heavy their hand is going to be. And I think pretty quickly was like reassured that it was going to go well. So, you know, there was people, David Levy, Matt Hung, Lenny Daniels, who really believed in Bleach Report and the vision of Bleach Report and allowed there to be autonomy for Bleach Report to just continue to grow. So like, it was like very similar to Flea Flicker. It was like, okay, they acquired it, but they just wanted to like give it more infrastructure and resources to do what it was already doing. It felt like the same with Bleach Report. It wasn't like somebody came in and was like, okay, now I'll produce a bunch of TV shows. It was just like, keep growing the digital presence that you have and keep connecting with the younger audience. And, you know, I think within, you know, a year, I felt really good about that acquisition.
That mandate of keep growing the digital presence, clearly that's worked well for you, because I think when I look at your career profile, you had three promotions in the first 4 years there. So it seems like your career was really taking off. Like, did you feel that you're like, hey, I think I've really found my groove here and I feel my career entering into like a new inflection point?
I think yes and no. Again, I think like it's all happening really quickly. And at the time, Bleacher Report was really young. So like, I think I started at Bleacher Report, I was like maybe 24 or 25, but the founders and the people running it were like 26 and 27, maybe, I think mostly 26. So there was a kind of like this natural cadence, like every year we would grow, every year we would get bigger. And we would take on, you know, the team would grow with it. So I was kind of along for that ride. And, you know, everybody was relatively young and inexperienced. So it wasn't like, you know, in the more traditional company, those promotion cycles are harder to come by. But there it just felt like, okay, this is it. I also think the promotions and everything was very rewarding and satisfying and very grateful for. But at the same point, like, I think myself and the team was like just really, really dead set on growing it. Like all the other stuff was like a little bit secondary. Can we hit these milestones? Can we unlock further VC investment? Can we get acquired? Even more so than that, like, can we build a big audience, right? Like we always wanted to chase and be as big or better than ESPN. It was always about this chase, you know, and everything else was kind of this like byproduct that was happening alongside it. And I think that chase was where like the majority of that chase and the audience was really where the majority of the focus was.
That chase though, Bleacher Report really evolves from a sports web called like 1.0 brand to like a dominant social media first kind of like multimedia company. And I think there was a big House of Highlights acquisition in 2016. So as part of this chase, was there something happening that led you to be like, hey, look at what Omar is doing. Like, we need to be part of that. We need to own that. And were you one of the first identifiers that's like, hey, we need to make a move here and maybe we should be acquisitive?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, that's exactly essentially the story. So I think we were having some early success on social. And then I kind of moved into a role of kind of overseeing the larger social org. And, you know, I think over the course of the 12 months, we went from kind of like a second, third player in the sports space behind some of the bigger names. And then we fast forward a year and we were just so maniacally focused on, you know, delivering the best social sports experience that when we picked our heads up 12 months, you know, we weren't only the best in category amongst sports accounts, right? We're like not only the best with like digital media, like young digital media accounts. We actually were like top two or three on Twitter. We were like overall, it was like Justin Bieber and then us at the time in terms of overall accounts. You know, the same on Facebook. You know, we were one of the top most engaged with accounts on Facebook. And then Instagram, you know, we were pretty early to Instagram. And, you know, we're starting to reach a point where we were a little bit more mature. The business was kind of solidifying itself. We had been around for, you know, a couple of years. and Instagram was really new. And I started to think a lot more about like, okay, we've always been a challenger brand, right? We've always been trying to unseat the established leaders. Who is going to do that for us? As we're so focused ahead, where's the risk? And the risk was like of somebody catching us from behind. And, you know, I was really in the mindset that Instagram was going to be, and it's like 15, 16, where it's like, you know, still only photos for a while. I was like, just transition to video and just like 15 second video. It was like, we always went to where the audience was. And the audience, you know, went from web to social, and then inside social from Facebook to Twitter to Instagram. So like, okay, well, we got to figure out Instagram. You know, very early on in House of Highlights lifespan, I became a really big fan of the account. I think when it had about 500,000 followers, led the acquisition, pitched it when it had 750,000 followers.
So you pitched it to your internal leadership, like, we should acquire Omar and this company.
At this point, we were having, I think Dave had transitioned out for a bit. We would have these like quarterly board meetings. And I ran through this deck, which outlined our pivot to social, kind of the social monetization business that we're looking to build and the store that we've developed in and around that. And on the last slide, I had something that I really did not want to be a throwaway, but I kind of was like, okay, there's a good chance this is going to be a throwaway. It was like, was this pitch to acquire House of Highlights? Luckily enough, the people in that room, again, Rory Brown, Matt Hong, Dave Pinocchio, you know, this guy named Sam Parnell, didn't dismiss it. They were like, okay, make it happen. And really gave the green light to go about and do it. And if you want to have fun, I would encourage you to try to pitch to a established media company, legal, finance, and HR departments, why you want to acquire an Instagram account, which again, people thought Instagram was just for like posting like rainbows and things like that, of a kid that at the time was 20 years old, yet to graduate college, was taking a decent amount of content that he didn't have ownership of and had no revenue other than selling pocket, like watch it, you know, ads for like 15 minutes. You know, that was definitely a very foreign pitch for a lot of people.
So did you have to go pitch like AOL Time Warner leadership as well? So like the Bleacher Report team was like, all right, Doug, yeah, go get the higher ups involved and like make it happen.
I got the green light from Bleacher Report leadership to go and pursue it. And then I had to get Bleacher Report finance people on board and all that. But ultimately, I think Dave and Rory and other people were responsible for getting the deal done. It wasn't the world's biggest deal. So I think they were just like, okay, kid, go and do it. We're not sure we really understand it, but you seem really passionate about it. And, you know, you guys have a pretty good track record. So
who reached out to Omar in the beginning? Did you kick off the conversation?
I reached out to him. I think I sent like an overly generic or vague message that was like, hey, big fan of your account. I'm from Bleacher Report. Would love to talk. I think he thought I was coming to like copyright him, like out of existence, you know?
This is on Instagram? Like you slid into his DMs?
No. He had an email on House of Positive. It was like, you know, again, a couple hundred thousand followers. So here is like a readily available email address. So I emailed him and he responded like basically like, I think I still have it. I got to find it. It's like, hi, what do you want? And I was like, oh, I just want to talk about ways in which you're a potential partner. And we got enough on a call, like I think literally that day or the next day. And yeah, I think I've told this story, but it's funny because I call him up, you know, we're having a great conversation, a couple of minutes. And like, he just stops me dead in the track. He's like, I got to hang up. I got to go. Kevin Love to sign in free agency and like hung up on me. And I was like, oh my God. Like at first I was like, this is a little like rude. Like here I am, the VP of social at Bleacher Report. This kid's like 20 years old. Like he thinks he's like basically applying for like an internship, telling me that he wants to get an internship with Miami Dolphins. And he hangs up on me. I was like, oh man, this is not great. And then I thought to myself for a second, it's like, that's actually exactly who I want to be working with. You know, somebody that's like so focused on their audience, so focused on the brand that they're building, that they're just going to hang up on like a prospective job opportunity or partnership opportunity. And from there, you know, we just got along really well. So we, you know, we talked over the intervening months and, you know, was able to acquire it on Jan 1 of that year. And the rest is kind of a history.
Has that purchase price been disclosed?
No, and it will not be disclosed.
Don't worry, this is not the podcast where I'm going to force you to say it. That's awesome. All right, so Omar comes in and it's like, okay, getting the deal done is part of the battle, but then it's actually like executing against the vision. And so this again is like, you know, you're an up and coming executive. And so the teams are looking at you like, hey, Doug, you just like made this deal happen. But now like, let's call it like reap what you've sown, right? Like, what are we going to do here together? And so were you responsible for setting the plan and making this all come to life?
Yeah. So, I mean, I became the general manager of House of Highlights relatively shortly after we acquired it. You know, my first job and the way I looked at it, you know, and I referenced it earlier, was really about playing defense. You know, so for me, it was about, I just want to put Omar, who was like a, you know, basically a savant when it comes to this stuff, in a position where he is not beholden to anything other than growing this page. So basically, I was like a left tackle and all, and I'd say like 50% of my job was just to allow him to continue to do exactly what he was doing. But, you know, with the rights from the NBA and with the better and a process for, you know, acquiring the user generated content. So obviously I have an analytics background and knew the platform intimately. And the two of us would just be insanely dedicated to growing the account, right? Like, you know, nobody was more dedicated than Omar, right? Like he lived, breathed it. And we would be texting every night at like 2 a.m. being like, do we need to do this? Do we do that? What about this post? Trying to find UGC. You know, really, really didn't even think about monetization or think about anything other than let's grow this audience. That was it. Like everything for the first, like, I want to say 2 years was only about audience and engagement. Like that was the 100% focus.
What did you learn reaching out, acquiring a company, really like a personality, and then integrating it to your org and being the leader here and the advocate? What was something that like surprised you? And then also something that's like, hey, this is how I became better from this experience.
Ooh, it's a really good question. I think in terms of what surprised me is I had somebody that had been primarily on the analytics and content side, and I hadn't really done a lot of the business side of it. And I think I had a, you know, kind of that like church and state divide and a little bit of, oh, come on, the business side, look at this audience, like you can figure this out, right? I think that was one of the things that I really matured on and had to learn how to get better at and was surprised by was just the amount of attention that you have to put into the fundamentals. You know, myself and Omar flew around the country the first year, like going to Seattle, like Oregon and LA and all over to pitch the House of Highlights brand. And it was, you know, that story and being there and really, you know, it's like going to the pizza guy and calling the, getting the chicken parmas for the newspaper. It's like that, where it's like, you know, you really got to be part of the sale. You really have to understand, how does this business make money? How does it scale? How do we build a support staff? All my jobs previous to Bleacher Report, you know, whether it's at ESPN Classic Now or AOL Sports Fan House or Versus, like basically everybody just got like let go at a certain point because the audience wasn't there. I really wanted to make sure, and I think this is one of the things that was also really key to that experience, was not getting too far ahead of yourself. You know, people had a real tendency to ask like, oh, where do you want to be in 5 years? And you know, these really hot digital media startups that were like, oh, we're going to take over the world. We're going to do this, that, and the other. And, you know, I remember sitting with Omar and being like, dude, the most important thing is that, like, first and foremost, that we're around, right? That we don't take that for granted, that we're building a business that's sound and that's sustainable and that could employ people and be successful, not just for the next, you know, year or 2 years, but really be successful for the next, you know, hopefully 20 to 50 years. And that was a really, really big part of it, was trying to build a foundation for a business that made sense. And that wasn't just like trying to chase every trend or trying to spend every potential dollar, but really trying to be really disciplined and focused.
Yeah. And that could even lead to, you know, conflict with the team that you acquired, like with Omar, for example, right? Like you're the GM, you have a vision for this need, like this needs to integrate well into the company. We need to be here for the next 20, 30 years. And you have to put your foot down on that, right? And the company was trusting you to make that happen. I liked your answer. That was definitely very compelling. So I'm now curious, fast forward to House of Highlights and Bleacher Report today. And I think a lot of peers and a lot of companies look at what you guys are doing, Doug, being like, this is like this whole test, learn, iterate, improve culture that clear like you've had in your 15 to 20 year career. That is something that you definitely deploy as a leader of this like multi-platform sports brand. And so I'm curious, like, what's a quick snapshot for our listeners of like, here are some of the big recent moves that we've made. But I'm also curious to hear, like, when you talk about really catering to Gen Z sports culture, what are you not doing that you guys should be? And what are you thinking about next that caters to this, like, the next generation of fandom?
The way we look at it is, like, we see ourselves as really being on the front lines of what's resonating with a younger sports audience every day. Across TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, we're posting anywhere from like 10 to 25 posts. And all of those posts serve as like signals to help better inform what our strategy needs to be in the moment, but also going forward. We also do a ton of research to just better understand the space. And what we've really started to see, and I think you kind of hit on this earlier, and House of Highlights was kind of this middle ground, is this fundamental shift from publishers towards personalities. And a big part of the acquisition of House of Highlights was recognizing that shift and trying to find a hybrid, and kind of Omar being something that, and House of Highlights being something that sat in the intersection of like publisher personality. And what we've seen is, you know, this shift increasing. So, you know, I was just looking back at like a doc from 2018 where we lay this out, where it's like we were really early to social and Instagram. We really want to be early to this shift towards personalities, and in particular, the creator space. So, you know, we've had a lot of success this past year of starting to create content in partnership with creators. So we've done our, you know, live creator competitions. So we have done, you know, Dodgeball, which was our most recent one, and ended up as the kind of the number one YouTube global trend, which we were really excited about. We have a Grand Prix coming up. We're really excited about. We've also started to do VODs. We did VOD versions of these competitions. So we did a Highlight House Gridiron or football where we, Clinton, brought four creators into a house and had them compete to determine who's the ultimate football creator. We're doing another one for basketball. So for me, it's really about doubling down on what's working. And I think that is where we see is working. You know, I think one of the hallmarks of my career is just kind of like building off of success is part of that test and learn process. Is we've never gotten to 100 before we've gotten to like 1 to 2 to 5 to 10 to 25, 50 and 100, right? So there's this ramp up. And I think that's what we're really seeing is we're really seeing this shift, right? If you look at, you know, I think 10% of Gen Z aspires to be a professional athlete today, where 35% aspires to be a creator. You know, 50% follow a creator on social media versus only 35% follow a team, athlete, or league. So fandom has shifted, and we're trying to orient ourselves around that shift in fandom and not just kind of go along for the ride, but really kind of lead that. And, you know, we've developed really, really good relationships with creators. So we're not just trying to parachute in now that like creator economy is a buzzy term. You know, a creator like Supreme Dreams, who's now as big a creator as there is, you know, I've known Mark and his family for the last 4 or 5 years. Kenny Beecham and Through the Wire, you know, who've become really big and influential in basketball, we've worked with them for 3 years. So you really have to put in, and Dan Levitt, who I know is on this podcast.
Oh, yeah. Got a lot of history with
personal friend and incredible businessman. Yeah, we've been establishing relationships in this space for a long time.
Well, that's a good point. Like when you say, Doug, that we've really been investing in relationships with creators, a lot of people ask, like, well, like, how do you do that? What does that include? And that, look, that's a really long conversation. But if you were to list out, like, here's how we approach creators differently. Here's like the 2 to 3 quick hits. What does that look like for House of Highlights and Bleacher Report?
It looks like this. So one is live creator competitions on a scale that nobody else is really doing them. I think that is a big, big part of it. I think the second is creator commentary, right? Historically, sports commentary has been driven either by two categories. One is former athletes, or two is traditional journalists. And what we've seen over time, and particularly of late, is a new class really come in and own that and play a major part in that. Now, people seek out creators for their thoughts and their commentary in and around sport. And we've worked really well in that. So I think that's kind of the second category. I think those are the competition angle, the commentary. Those are kind of the big one and twos of it. And then also the incubation. You know, we've incubated creators internally. For an example, we have a creator on our team named the Broadcast Boys, they went from zero to 2.2 million followers on TikTok, and we helped, you know, incubate them to success. We work with a creator named Dupika, another TikToker who's closing in on a million, who we've helped incubate to success on those platforms, and then really give them the opportunity to shine, you know, help them connect to a bigger and broader audience that we have and allow them to kind of tap into opportunities that might not be there historically. So we just signed a creator named Nasher, who's really big in hockey. And is, you know, the opportunity that we present is not just like us leveraging his audience, which is a big part of it, but also him leveraging our rights and him leveraging the ability to appear on linear television. So I think that's kind of how we look at ourselves and the differentiation that we present.
Awesome. Very well said, Doug. Two final questions from me before we get into rapid fire. One, you know, similar to your mindset back in 2015, 2016, which is like, hey, Bleacher Report, we're ahead of the pack. So who's coming for us? So who is that for you right now? / like who inspires you, whether it's directly in sports or another modern digital publisher? Who is that right now?
Very enamored and impressed by what FaZe and Thieves have both developed. I think what they've accomplished.
FaZe Clan and 100 Thieves?
Right. FaZe Clan and 100 Thieves. I think what they've developed is really, really remarkable to build like the modern version of the Cowboys or the Yankees is essentially what they're doing, right? I think that is really, really impressive. And I'm very, have a lot of awe and respect for what they've done and are doing. I also look at, you know, individuals, right? Like I take a lot of like inspiration from, you know, whether it's Dan's group, Too Hype, and kind of these collector creatives, I think are really exciting to watch. What Mr. Beast has done, a lot of like what Knight Media has done is really interesting. Whether I got young kids so like Preston and Lanky Box, how they've kind of gone from these social presence, these, you know, individual social media presences to kind of these full on really big media brands. I have a lot of admiration for what they've accomplished. And then, you know, when I look at, you know, the guys that we work with, Through the Wire, Kenny Beecham being a great example, Supreme Dreams, RDC, another great example. They've developed cult followings, and that's an incredibly hard thing to do, is to be able to really build and grow an audience that isn't transitory, that just doesn't go like with the scroll, but really believes and loves you. And I think those groups have really developed that. And, you know, if you can build anything like that, that's remarkably impressive. And then, you know, just on like a really, really small level, you know, like I'm a big US soccer fan. So there's, you know, a podcast called Scuffed that I, you know, have a lot of respect for, up and coming. They do a really awesome job, like hyper targeting a niche and being as good at it as possible. There's a Twitter account called Watki, and it's just like this one small US soccer account, but he has the most unique voice. And I take, you know, so much inspiration from this one person and their, like their uniqueness of voice and their ability to cut through clutter. I'm really like inspired by that. And then one of the guys that worked for us, Full Squad Gaming, which has become a really big gaming brand on TikTok. I really consume the space a lot. So there's a lot of things out there that I really enjoy. And so sorry, that answer was long-winded.
You know, I think it like what stands out is that you're a decision maker, an operator, and you run a business, but you're also a total fan.
Oh, for sure.
And I think by being a fan and immersing yourself in just like the content and the creators and the publishers that you think are doing great work, that inspires you and that makes you better.
Yeah, right? 100%.
All right, one last question before rapid fire. We've talked about the evolution like of your leadership philosophy. One thing that surprised me in a very positive way is that you had a leadership philosophy from a very early age when you were running the school newspaper at Pomona. If you were to capture a big evolution in how your leadership philosophy has changed from then to now, also, I think in being honest, where do you see gaps or areas for you to improve as a leader to take your career and your team to like the next level in the next 10, 20 years of you doing what you're doing?
You know, in terms of where the leadership over the last like 10 or 20 years, I guess at this point I'm dating myself, has evolved is just a lot of maturation in terms of like understanding the big picture, right? So I think when you're younger and you're starting off, you only kind of see things through like your lens. And what I've learned over time is everybody is doing their best, sometimes under difficult situations. And empathy towards that makes you more productive and the team more productive, right? Like instead of being frustrated or jaded or like casting something aside because they're not in agreement with you or they're not moving as quickly. Really understanding like everybody has challenges and everybody's trying to do their best. And I think that learning kind of, you know, like takes those points of frustration where you're like quicker to lose your cool, I guess, in a way, and like, and resets it and reorients it. And it's like, okay, let me try again. Let me figure out like where their struggles are, what their challenges are. And, you know, when you have your own employees, you're also trying to like give them that context where they're frustrated with me or they're frustrated with a peer or somebody underneath them. It is that sense of perspective, you know, I think I really lacked at the earlier stages and that I'm starting to get more of, but I think there's a whole world of perspective that I still have to go. And I think that's the biggest thing is just like continuing to be open to learning and growing and trying to like seek out different and new perspectives. I think that's a really big part of it. Yeah, I think just in terms of that philosophy to improve moving forward in terms of leadership, you know, I think I've always tried to value people, but I think there's a depth of valuing people and their experiences that the last 24 months has really kind of pushed forward, you know, particularly around DE&I, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Like I think that's really come to the forefront. And I think everybody, especially myself included, has work to be done on that front. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's like a laundry list of things that I probably need to work on that I'm sure
you're very self-aware and reflective.
Like hitting deadlines and things like that. But I think, you know, the big thing is just trying to gain a greater sense of scale and perspective. I think that's a big thing.
Doug, yeah, before we go into the rapid fire, I'm just going to give you some quick kudos. I've gotten to know you. I think I first met you through my colleague, Andrew Cohen, who knows Drew, one of the members of your team. And I think we just first chatted, was it like 6 to 9 months ago, if I remember correctly. And I remember like that first conversation, you know, I talk to people in the industry all the time. And you're like, are we going to be on the same page? Do we think the same? Are we going to vibe? And I just remember, I was like, Doug and Drew are just awesome people. And I was like, I really like these guys. And I get why their business is performing so well, because not only do they get it and are they super sharp, but they're grounded, they're building a great team, and they just have a great ethos. So then when I was like, oh, I'm excited to interview you for this podcast, you know, some people just fall into their careers, right? They're these just like unique trajectories that there's no expectations, it's unplanned. But we were joking about this during the break. It feels like you are completely fulfilling your destiny. Like you were born on this earth as a lover and obsessor of all things sports and community and media. And that has been something that started out, you know, with your family, with your father, and very early years for you. And I think that you had a vision for this early on, right? When you were writing in your like third grade journals. And you have more than fulfilled, I think, the career expectations that you have had. And it's amazing to hear your story. And I think, honestly, that what I'm hearing is that you're just getting started. I've interviewed a lot of executives. I advise a lot of them. And there's something I'm hearing in between the lines here. I'm like, there are some big moves that Doug's going to make over the next decade or so. Whether that's with Bleacher Report and House of Highlights or somewhere else, very excited to follow that. And I think that also a second note just is like your self-awareness around your leadership from how early on that you've been thinking about it. I think that really sets you up for success. It's inspiring. And look, some of these questions I previewed with you in advance and a lot I didn't. And for you to have such thoughtful answers, like off the cuff, I'm like, that really shows something about your leadership character. So kudos on that. I've learned a lot from you during this conversation.
I appreciate it. It's been a great conversation. Excited for the rapid fire. And I do very genuinely appreciate that. It does mean a tremendous amount.
Very welcome. All right. So here are the rules for the rapid fire segment. 6 questions. Answers are to be one sentence or maybe just one or two words. Quick phrase. Do you understand the rules?
Yes, I do.
Let's get into it. Doug, proudest life moment?
Having my children.
What do you want to do less of in 2021?
Eat just crappy food.
Okay. What do you want to do more of?
Spend time with my kids. That's the big one. Continue to be able to play with them more, not just kind of like spend time, like active, engaged time.
What are 1 to 2 things that primarily drive your success?
Curiosity is a big one.
Advice for media execs going into 2022.
Value your people above all else.
Any future startup ambitions for you?
Happy where I'm at right now.
Very safe, quality answer. All right, last one. This is an easy one. How can people get in contact with you?
D Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, at bleacherreport.com would be the main one. I think I'm also on Twitter as, let me see, I think I'm D.T. Bernstein on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, got to look up your handle.
Yeah, D.T. Bernstein on Twitter. Those would be the two best ways.
You now know how to get to Doug. You can flood his inbox or his Twitter DMs. Well, Doug, this has been a delight. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Been a pleasure. Excellent job. It was great speaking with you.
Wow, that was a really fun conversation. You know, I've gotten to know Doug just over the past year, year and a half or so. And I knew that he had a pretty lengthy sports media career, but I didn't know it went that deep, where his earliest memories were literally that of sport and going to games with his family. Pretty amazing. All right, reminder that it really helps us out when you guys share our episodes. So if you really enjoy this conversation between me and Doug, share it on LinkedIn, share it on Twitter, anywhere in social media. It helps other people find the show. And it allows me and Rockwater to keep putting out these podcasts and interviewing these great executives. And it also really helps us if you can go and rate the show wherever you listen to it. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, go and give us a 5-star rating, leave a review. It really helps other people find our work, and that would really mean a lot. So appreciate the help, everybody. And as always, thanks again for listening. If you have any thoughts on the show, any ideas for guests, hit us up at tcupod@wearerockwater.com. All right, everyone. Till next time. The Come Up is written and hosted by me, Chris Irwin, and is a production of Rockwater Industries. Please rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe wherever you listen to our show. And if you really dig us, feel free to forward the Come Up to a friend. You can sign up for our company newsletter at wearerockwater.com/newsletter. And you could follow us on Twitter at TCUPod. The Come Up is engineered by Daniel Turek. Music is by Devin Bryant. Logo and branding is by Kevin Zazali. And special thanks to Andrew Cohen and Mike Booth from the Rockwater team.